Shalom. Thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery through the book of Deuteronomy.
Welcome back to our series in Deuteronomy, Theophilus. We took a little bit of time in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and 6 because there are so many interesting things to discuss there. I'm going to have to go a little bit quicker or we'll never get to the end of this whole book, right? Let me look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 24. The last two verses, it says, "The Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes." That's everything that's gone on before. "To fear the Lord our God for our good always." Look at that, right? So, again and again, the Bible presents the law as being something for our good. It's never something that's onerous, a burden. But somehow, if you think about it, maybe even from Paul onwards, the law gets this very negative perception, right? And today in church, people almost talk about the law as a bad thing. But really, God Himself, Yahweh Himself says that this is something that's for our good. So the law is for our good, that He might preserve us alive as it is today, right? And then, interestingly, it says, "This will be the righteousness for us." Okay, look, the Bible doesn't make a whole lot of these types of statements. But here it says, this is what righteousness is. If we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God, as He has commanded us, right? Remember, Jesus said something similar. "If you love me, keep my commandments," right? So, there is a very consistent theme. I think there are things that we need to work out. What does it mean to keep the law? Now, which laws? And if you stick with us, right, I think by the time we get to about the 20s, chapter 20-something, you get lots of application of what it means to actually keep this law. And hopefully, you will see why the law is as relevant today as it ever was. Okay, so now we're going to continue in chapter 7. Now, we get to more interesting stuff. They're all interesting, right? Every verse is like super interesting. Verse 1, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and He casts out many nations before you," and then it goes on to list these seven nations, right? The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, Canaanites, the Perizzites, look at that, Perizzites, right? The Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. "When the Lord your God delivers them over to you, and you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them, and you shall make no covenant with them or show mercy to them." Let's just pause here real quick because there are several things interesting. First of all, there's these seven nations. Why are these seven nations? Well, they are the inhabitants of this land called Canaan, right? So, a couple of things about that. I mean, by the way, in Genesis, you have another list of nations as well, including some of these, but altogether, 10 nations were listed there, right? In Genesis chapter 15, verse 19 to 21. But what is interesting for me is that when you go into this land, God is going to deliver them to you. Verse 2, it says, "You shall conquer and utterly destroy." Is that what it says in your Bible? Utterly destroy? Do you have this? What is utterly destroy? And this comes from the Hebrew word hacherem, right? And harem, of course, means like banned things. You know, actually in Malay, we have a word haram, right? That's sort of like the root word, hacherem. So this word utterly destroy is a very, very powerful word, right? And actually, we're going to read a little bit about what this actually constitutes. In fact, let me have a look, right? Well, it can refer to things that are an abomination to God, right? These are things. It can refer to things that are holy. And therefore, you can no longer touch this, right? So that's you can see that, for example, in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 28. But this kind of utter destruction has to do with how they are to actually conquer the land, right? So we're going to look at this. Verse 3, it says, "You shall not marry them, you shall not give your daughters their son or take their daughters." So in this Canaanite land, specifically in this Canaanite, you shall not marry. Okay? No, that means you cannot give your daughter, you not allow your daughter to be married into their peoples, and you're not to marry your son to one of their daughters. Right? So no marriages whatsoever. Why? Verse 4, "For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." Right? So the reason that's being given for this whole section on Hacherem, why do you need to utterly destroy them, why you cannot marry them one way or the other, why you are not even allowed to make any covenant with them. By the way, you find later on they did make some covenant with them, right? With the Hivites. The Hivites were the people from Gibeon. They came up to Joshua. They, you know, pretended to be something else. They actually made a covenant with them. So this was one of the things they were told not to do. Of course, they were careless. They were tricked, you could say that. But this was something that they were told not to do, right? And it's interesting that when they did make that covenant, they actually ended up honoring the covenant, notwithstanding this particular instruction. And that really helps us to think, you know, actually, is there like a hierarchy of instructions, you know? I mean, which is more important? And maybe here's something for us to think about. Just a couple of other comments. Jebusites. The Jebusites, well, the city of Jebus was actually the old name for the city of Jerusalem. That's what it was, right? So, and of course, sometimes Jebus, the city of Jebus was also called the city of Salem, or Salem, or Shalom, all right? And of course, you know this from Genesis, because in Salem, there was a high priest by the name of Melchizedek, right? Which actually literally means the righteous king. So lots of stuff that, you know, actually I have so many interesting discussions about Melchizedek and all that, but that's for Genesis, isn't it? Because we have actually some of these inscriptions from Sapphire 1, 750 BC about all the stuff about what exactly, were they actually worshipping El Elyon, you know, the God, the highest God? Was this the name of, okay, very interesting stuff. That's Genesis. Wait for it, okay? It may never come, but we are in Deuteronomy. Okay, and we want to talk about this whole idea of idolatry, because that's going to be a major, major theme in Deuteronomy. You'll find this like probably in 20-30% of the text is about no idolatry. So what is Hacherem? So when they enter a city, they are to kill every living thing. Every man, every woman, every child, every baby, and also animals. Wow, that is so extreme. And I know there are some non-Christians who are looking at this and there you go, you know, that's your angry and murderous God, you know. So what was the reason? I mean, to be honest, I don't think we can fully explain everything, you know, being that we are 3,000 years apart. But I think some of the reasons are given. First, this is not just about war or conquest. It's about the extermination of idolatrous practices. Because Moses, and I guess God, knew that basically this was what's going to happen. If you leave anyone, somehow that's going to come back and they're going to bite you in the end, right? And that includes the animals. Although the animals, you will see that they actually kept some of the animals. Earlier on, you remember when they were in Heshbon and they were in Bashan, right? They kept the animals. So, well, those animals are maybe not Canaanite animals, maybe. So, those guys got lucky. As you go on, you discover that they didn't always do this. To what extent did they actually prosecute this particular instruction? We are not super sure, right? We know that King Saul spared Agag and kept the animals. That's why Samuel came around and said, what's all this bleating of the sheep that I'm hearing, right? Clearly, you're supposed to kill Hacherem, but, oh yeah, I already did it, but you know, I thought I'll keep this. Okay, it was a serious instruction, but the seriousness is coming from the place that relates to idolatry. God hates idols. God hates idolatry. God hates the worship of any other gods other than himself. And he is a jealous God. So that's where this is coming from, right? The other thing that you may find interesting to know is, by the way, this is what all those nations used to do, right? It's not just Israel who did this. If someone else came in, they would, and they were, let's say, conquering Israel cities, they would do the same thing. They would destroy everybody, right? So that was sort of like what war meant in those days. That was part of the contextual reality, the rules of war, right? So, for example, if you look in Assyria, 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 11. Let's quickly look at that. 2 Kings 19, verse 11, right? Look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by utterly destroying them. So you, this is, like I said, this is not, it's the same word, hakharam, or in this case, haram. So this is not a uniquely Israel thing. This is what war in those days looked like, right? This war. I mean, you might think this is so cruel. But think about this. When they dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, everything went. Okay, you're just like, I'm just kill the soldiers. But War is war. Of course, now you might say, now we are trying to be a bit more precise. We have all these laser-guided missiles. Even then, in war, you know, people get killed. There are always collaterals. So I think instead of thinking, why is God like this? I think this is also part of the reflection of the culture of that day. This is the law in the context of Canaanite reality, right? So it's not just them. Of course, you find in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 11. Let me take a look real quick. Verse 11, it says, look, you have heard what... Okay, actually, it's the same verse, right? Isn't it? It's repeating the same thing. Assyrians have done the same thing, utterly destroying them. So, Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 9, let's have a look at what Babylonians did, right? Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 9, it says, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, says the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar the king, and bring them to the land and will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment. Now, this is talking about someone attacking Israel, right? And this is, I guess, Nebuchadnezzar will attack Israel and he will utterly destroy them, right? Make them an astonishment, a hissing, perpetual desolation. Okay, so I just want to mention that because I think for some people, this is a real problem. You know, how can they kill the innocent babies? War is war. It's nothing personal, you might say that. Of course, it's personal if it's your baby, right? But as a matter of war, that was the sort of the rules of war, the culture of the day. It wasn't something that only Israel did. It was pretty much what everyone did. But for Israel, the reason was so that idolatry would not find its way into the community of God's people, right? Covenants. I earlier mentioned that they were not allowed to make covenants with the people. Covenants were really, really important for the Middle Eastern culture. Your word is your worth, you know. I mean, if you break your covenant. So I found it really interesting that Joshua in chapter 9, when he makes this covenant with the Gibeonites, he actually has to honor them. Not only has he got to honor them, he actually came to their rescue when they were being attacked by the other nations, right? So I guess this goes back to the commandment about letting your yes be yes, not taking the name of God in vain. You make an oath, you keep it. Even though keeping it might be to your disadvantage, right? So if you have made a promise to someone and you find that in order to honor that promise, you are going to lose out, your word is worth more than whatever things that you might lose out. Okay, then that's really why we see that whole hierarchy in terms of... Now, that is as much true for the law as it is of the cultural reality. Now, today, I don't know if people actually honor their words as much today, right? People say that, I will meet you at 3 o'clock and then they show up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. You know, I said, what? I didn't promise in the name of, you know, God or something like that. All right. I only said so on here. Okay, look, maybe as a Christian, we need to think about, as Christian, our testimony includes that, keeping your word, right? Keeping your promises, not lying. So let me look at chapter 7, verse 3. Nor shall you make marriage. Oh, okay, so actually, we already discussed this, right? No marrying. We'll get more details about this later on. We know that they did not keep this. Now, which actually is kind of curious, right? We know they actually married the people. Now, wait, if they harem them, there'll be nobody left to marry, right? So clearly, they did not prosecute this to the fullest extent. In other words, they didn't really kill everybody. And I think that seems to be, yeah, you might imagine that case. It's kind of hard to go out killing so many people, right? There are some cases where it says they will kill all these cities. But if they really did kill all these people, then where's all this intermarrying going to come from, right? So we have that. Of course, later on, you know, Solomon famously married all kinds of people, right? Including people who are pagans. And we know at the end of his life, exactly what they were afraid would happen, right? The wives turned his heart away from God. So you can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 to 10, right? Solomon's life, how he overestimated himself and said, no, it won't happen, you know. We understand. We don't have to kill all. We understand that we will not worship their gods. But we all start off saying that we are pretty confident of ourselves. Verse 5, you are to destroy their Mizbeach, all right? Mizbeach, which is their altars. And they will have many altars for their gods. Their sacred pillars, Matzavot is like, almost like stone monuments. Okay, monuments, you have to destroy the monuments to their gods, break it into pieces, and the Asherahs. So what is an Asherah? An Asherah is actually the consort of the high god. So they have many names of the high gods. The high gods will be like El. They'll call their god El, but El is kind of a generic name, but their god is also called Baal, is another name that they use to refer to their god, which can also mean husband or master or like Adon, like that, right? Hadad is another name of the god. And the gods, their gods, or Ia is another name that those of you have been have looked at my Genesis series to remember from some of these Canaanite and Akkadian pantheon of gods. There's this god called Ia. They have a consort. There's like a wife, right? So Asherah was like the wife of the god. But you know, Jehovah has no wife, right? He's like, he doesn't need a wife. Okay, so so God didn't want to be associated with anything to do with the ideas of their worship, their altars, their style. No, God doesn't want any of that, right? You will worship me differently from how you think about all those other gods. So you have to destroy all their Asherah poles, which often was like a tree that's planted next to an altar or next to a high place. They'll put it together because husband and wife got to keep them together, right? So God says, you will destroy all of these things. And they actually never really did destroy all of these things. I think probably Josiah, up until Josiah, that was probably the time that they came closest to destroy everything, right? Okay, I'm going to kind of move on real quick here. Verse 6 to 8 is simply a reiteration of the covenantal promise that God made to them, right? In Exodus 19, verse 5 to 6. Verse 9 tells you a little bit about what God is like. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, He's God, right? He is the faithful God, He's Emunah. He's a faithful God. He's a covenant-keeping God who keeps the covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations of those who love Him and keep His commandments. And of course, He is also, how should I say this? He will punish His enemies, right? He repays those who hate Him to their face. Actually, this translation here, does your English translation say to their face? That's interesting, right? Because the Hebrew actually doesn't say that. Right? He repays those who hate Him to His face. In other words, people who hate God to God's face. Right? I think that's, if my Hebrew is not wrong, I think that's what it means. Because otherwise, what does it mean? How do you hate Him to their face? How do you pay them to their face? Kind of cut off their face or something like that. Okay, so some of these translators, I really am... There's always a good chunk of translation weirdness that goes with in English translations, right? But we can always learn Hebrew. Right? To destroy them, He will not be slack with them, Him who hates Him. And He will repay. Okay, so He will repay Him to His face. So let's kind of recap for a bit before we jump on, because we're coming to a slightly different section now. What are the four things that this entire section captures for us? The four things. Shema. Hear these things, right? And then the three things that follow hearing is Lamad, learn it, study it. Figure it out, right? Which is what we're trying to do. Kind of work this out. What does this mean for us? Second thing, Shomer. Keep watch over this. In other words, keep this close to your heart. Bind them to your forehead, your hands, your mezuzot, you know, your doorpost, your waking up. Keep them, remember them. And then the last one is Asot, to do them. Okay, these are the, if you want to summarize this whole section, we have basically covered from chapter 5 up to this point, which is chapter 7, verse 11. It says, therefore, you shall keep the commandment, the statutes, the judgment which I command you today to observe them. Right? Of course, then to do them. So that brings us to chapter 7, verse 12, which is kind of a new section.
There's a question here. Why was Achan and I punished so badly? While in Deuteronomy 7, the religious ban was not instituted maybe at the end of Joshua's conquest.
Actually, the ban is already instituted right now already, right? You can see the laws are already given before they went into the land. They were told exactly what they're supposed to do. And I think Achan, he knew what he was not supposed to do. He clearly took some of the ban things, right? So he clearly defied God. Why was he punished so badly? I think partly to make an example out of him. Because you know what? You know, like we had this guy in Singapore. His name was called Michael Fay. Right? Since then, we haven't had this problem, you know. I mean, honestly, well, almost didn't have, right? Because it was made an example of. I don't think we'll make every single person punished in the same way. But that was really, I think it was, because it's so new, I think there was a sense in which, okay, you guys better know this is what happens, right? Because you don't set your record straight at the beginning, people will think, you know, it doesn't really matter. I can just do whatever I want to do. So I think that's part of it. I think secondly, I think that would have been, the main reason, if you would consider that. Secondly, I don't think he was punished so severely. He was punished exactly how God said he would punish him, all right? It wasn't as if, okay, I'm going to give you like plus punishment. No, he was punished exactly how God said, if you are going to do that, you will be cut off, right? And that pretty much means that you're going to get killed.
Then, of course, the question to that was, why then did they not keep to the religious ban, especially
later on?
Yeah, later.
Yeah, we will come to that later on because, you know, that's part of the interesting discussions that come. So we will discuss, you know, because when you get passed into this section, you actually get into a lot of case law, right? So what actually happens, some of the actual laws that pertain to what you must do when you go to war and so on. We'll actually come to that. I want to go a little bit quickly, but we'll actually visit that point when we get to it, right? So verse 12, it says, then it shall come to pass, okay? The Hebrew is that it shall come, then it shall be Ekev. Ekev, if you listen carefully, sounds like Yaakov. Yaakov is Jacob, right? Why was Jacob called Jacob? Because Ekev is the heel. He was holding on to the heel, right? So the word Ekev is what you get in the English. It shall come to pass. In other words, if I were to translate this in a more literal sense, it will be a consequence of. It will follow on the heels of, right? So if something following on the heels of means that it will come right after the consequence of this thing. So it shall be the consequence because you listen to this judgment. The consequence of listening to these judgments and keep and do them. Remember, we just read in the previous verse that you shall, you shall observe them, you shall keep them, right? Now here it says the assault, you shall do them, that the Lord will keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore to his fathers, right? So the consequence, now that's really interesting because, you know, a lot of people think, our covenant with God is unconditional. Actually, it's very conditional. You know, I think this whole idea of unconditional is a bit of a hyperbole. Hyperbole is to say an exaggeration, right? You want to say God's love is, you know, so unconditional. No, clearly there are some conditions. But I understand when people say that they're not making a theological statement, right? Because theologically there are conditions. Even with Jesus, the condition is that you must repent. That's at the very least one condition, right? But people say, no, you know, this is unconditional. Now, there are, of course, Calvinists who have a different take on this. They call prevenient grace. In other words, God already chose you and God will give you whatever it takes to make you safe, right? In other words, give you the ability to repent and so on and so forth, right? Prevenient grace so that it's nothing to do with you. It's completely unconditional. I'm not a Calvinist, right? So I think I can see in the law there are really very conditional aspects of our covenant with God. So here's one of them. As a condition, or not, well, not condition, as a consequence, if you keep this law, well, what happens if you don't keep this law? Well, you can kind of read it down. This is the good news part of it. So it tells you what happens if you keep the law, right? Let me see if I can move on real quick. Actually, we are running out of time, but verse 13, right? The meat of promises, verse 13 to 15, it says, he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb, that is your children, the fruit of your hand, your work, your grain, your new wine. You know, we like to quote these verses, right? You know, he will make you the head and not the tail. Okay, oh, remember this. This is the consequence. This is not just for anyone who walks in the room. This is for those people who walk in the way of God, right? Increase your cattle, offspring, and again, this is for kindergarten also, right? This is the most basic thing. Because later on, you'll find in the Bible, people like Job, who does all these things, and he still experienced some difficulty. But remember, this is just laying the foundational stuff. We are in the kindergarten right now. Okay, maybe we are slightly better than kindergarten. We are primary school right now, right? You shall be blessed above all peoples. There shall not be a male or female barren. Think about this. Not a male or female barren among you or all your livestock. Does this mean that in the time of the conquest, every woman could have children? Literally, there was not a single barren woman. Well, clearly we knew there are a few women who struggled with barrenness. Right? Hannah, for one. Right? I mean, we can say God answered her prayer and gave her Shemuel, because Shema, yeah, El, God heard, right? So, I don't think so. I think you have to not take these words in this kind of extensive literalness. And that every single person, and I think as Christians, the way we read the Bible tends to be like this, because we're only reading it in a very superficial, very literal sense. But really, you try to understand this. This means in general. This is not to say that not a single woman in all of Israel was somehow barren. Not barren. Not a single one was barren. Right? I don't think it means... It does not mean that every single animal was not barren. Right? And later on, you see, it says other things as well. It says that you shall be blessed above of all people. And the Lord will take away from you all sicknesses. We love this verse. See, God will take away all sickness. Recently, we had a preacher who said, you know, there's no verse in the Bible that says God will take away all sicknesses. Right? Well, here you go. Right? There is one, but the sense, again, you cannot take this to mean that therefore nobody was ever sick. If that was the case, why would they have so many laws about lepers and leprosy and so on and so forth? Clearly, when we read verses like this, it's important for us to understand that these words are to be taken in the context of what was God was saying in general to the people. If you obey me, God will bless you. And part of blessing will include health. But it does not mean, therefore, that every single person will not be sick, right? And I think, again, there have been examples. Remember Job, his body broke out in boils. And God said, no, he's a righteous man. He's not sin. So that really challenges our primary school thinking. It forces us to get out from the literal way and begin to step a bit more into the sense of what it's supposed to mean. And of course, then it goes on to say that, okay, by the way, the other thing about these sicknesses and the diseases, right? So there are many different words that are used, holy sicknesses, but some of these terrible diseases refers to the plagues. You know, so you not get the, I guess, the frogs and the blood, the red Nile water, and you won't get those kind of plagues. And then, of course, you shall destroy all the peoples, you know, whom the Lord delivers over to you. Your eye will have no pity on them. Look at that. That's a hard word, isn't it? No pity, no mercy. Nor shall you serve their gods. So the context in which we understand all of these things is that why should you not have pity on them? Because it's hacherem. You want to wipe out idolatry from the land. But we do have to be merciful in general, okay? Verse 16 is simply a recap of the instructions, right? Verse 16, it says, you shall destroy all the people, and that's the hacherem instructions. Let me look at verse 18 and 19. It says, you shall not be afraid of these people of the land. You shall remember Zikaron, right? That the Lord... So this theme of remembering God is very frequent. Remember God when you're fighting your enemies. Remember the law of God. Remember, remember, remember.
There is one question that's particularly interesting. It is the law or commandment in Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 2, that means applying to the religious ban, seems to apply to Canaanite idolatry. Is there any way which we can apply this same religious ban today in our context?
Okay, it's very interesting. When you look in Deuteronomy, and as we go on, you'll discover this, there is a distinction between Canaanites and non-Canaanites, right? There are some laws that says, well, you with this group of people, you have to utterly destroy them, but with the cities that are very far away, meaning that maybe way out in the north, out of Canaan, right? Then you have a slightly different way of dealing with that. And we will actually come to this. So it is making a kind of distinction. Why is it making that kind of distinction? And maybe there's something particularly insidious about the idolatry of Canaan that God particularly dislikes, could well be that. But I think in general, God doesn't like any kind of idolatry, right? I think you've discovered this, you know, you're allowed to marry, not marry these people, but there are some people that you're allowed to take wives from the captives. In some cases, again, you discover this. So I don't think it's so obvious, although, you know, it's tempting for us to just kind of generally classify this. But when you go through the laws, especially the case laws, you discover that it's actually a little bit more refined. There are distinctions that are being made. So maybe we'll come to that when we get to those verses, right? There's this verse 24 here, which he says, and he will deliver the king. This God is promising, right? There's a whole chunk of promises going on here. He will deliver the kings into your hands, and you will destroy their name from under heaven. Look at that. No one shall be able to stand against. Okay, what does it mean to destroy your name from under heaven? That is to wipe them out completely. Now, we know this quite well because, you know, in all these Chinese dramas, right? When somebody ascends to the throne, the first thing he does is go and wipes out all the contenders, okay? Any contenders, their cousins and nephew, nieces, he'll wipe them out completely. So that is actually, you know, you want to understand what is Hakerem. It's not even just a Middle Eastern thing. Even Chinese, we have this sort of thing. They are trying to wipe them out to secure certain things. But the other thing that is interesting from this wipe out from is to wipe someone's name out from under heaven is actually a curse, right? To remove their mention altogether is actually a kind of curse, right? So if you go to Israel today, you find that they have a Holocaust museum, right? So the Nazis were trying to wipe out the Jews from the face of the earth. It was crazy. They were killing millions and millions and millions of Jews for no reason. And they were bent on doing that, to wipe them out. And now they've put up a Holocaust museum. The Holocaust museum is called Yad Vashem, right? Yad actually means, okay, I mean a hand, but it probably means a place. A place, and Shem means name. A place and a name, right? So you try to wipe them out, but now they're giving them a place and a name so that they will be remembered forever. So again, you have this whole Zikron, this whole idea of remembrance that's very important. So Yad Vashem, of course, they get the name from Isaiah chapter 56, verse 5. And to have a name and a place is really important for a Jew, right? They didn't really think about heaven back in those days. Almost no mention is made about heaven or the afterlife. But they think, I want to have a name. I want to have a descendant, right? Abraham's lament is, you know, what good is all this if I have no descendants, right? Are we forgotten? So that whole idea of perpetuation, that's really important. It's not so important to us now. Although sometimes when I read this and I think, you know, I don't have a son, right? My daughter married someone that so I've got no name and no place anymore, right? I got to have my own Yad Vashem. So, you know, to have a place and a name. But really, I want to mention that because it's a concept we seldom talk about, right?
There's another question here that seems to be rather persistent. That is, should God punish everything that we don't keep? For example, if the Israelites did not persecute the religious ban to its utter end, and God didn't punish them. Should we hope for God's punishment on them?
I think as you grow older, you learn that not everything is just one blanket rule, right? First of all, does God punish disobedience? I think so. I think He does. But how exactly does He punish disobedience? Different ways. Sometimes, okay, because you know you that's what you want to do, right? Remember when God told them to go into the land, and they say no, you know, there's giants in the land, we don't want to go in. Fine, if you don't go in, we are not going in. They brought that upon themselves. That 40 years, you know, God wanted them to go in, they didn't want to go in. So why did they spend 40 years in the wilderness? I don't think it was so much God saying that I'm going to make life miserable. Look, you didn't want to go in, right? You yourself made a choice. Now this is the consequence. So there's a certain punishment that's a consequence. I think that some of the punishment is educational, right? Because like in the case of Achan, God had to help people to understand, look, God is not to be trifled with. Now, I mean, people had to learn this all through. Remember when David was celebrating, bringing the ark in, and then they were all happy, right? And then God told them, you cannot touch this thing, but they forgot. And that's a bit like children. Sometimes they forget, right? They're good. In their midst of their fun, they forget a very important rule. And okay, stop. No more fun time now. Okay, now it's not fun time anymore. And you have to learn something. So does God punish people? Yeah, obviously. I think He has to, right? Because you see, let your yes be yes, right? If He says He's going to do it, He's going to do it. And but how He does it, I think that's probably room to discuss, you know. Maybe sometimes He more immediate, and sometimes, I mean, He was really immediate. lots of people will be dying in church, you know. I'm just like, yeah, I guess so, right? You come to church on the wrong day and, you know, boom, the lightning is like, half the church just died, you know, so, or something like this, right? I think that there's a great measure of mercy in judgment as well, right? So, yeah, we can discuss this. I think this is sort of like no clear-cut answer to that question.
So perhaps in short, can you explain maybe how the Israel might have suffered as a consequence of not the religious ban?
Oh, man. Well, the first consequence is that they actually never got rid of idolatry in the land. The North Kingdom went down and down and down and down, basically, right? Even the Southern Kingdom, Solomon. Solomon was the pinnacle. You know, countries came from afar to... He had wisdom. He had everything you can ever hope to have. And he had those women who led his heart astray. And from there on, it was pretty much downhill all the way, right? So how did they punish? How did they suffer as a direct consequence of their... Look, the laws are for your own good, right? If that tells you don't touch the cable and you can persistently do it, I did die. One day you might die, okay? All right. So, why do you punish me? I told you not to do it, right? And so I think the whole idea of punishment as vengeance, I think is probably something that people struggle with. But this is not punishment as vengeance. This is for your own good. The law is for your own good. You don't keep it. It's not simply disobeying God. You are doing something contrary to your own good, right? So I think that would be, So I'll just kind of do that. So anyway, God is very, very particular about this whole idea of not following the ways of... In fact, in verse 25, it says, you shall burn the calf images of your God with fire. That's how you should deal with them, right? You shall not covet the silver or the gold. So someone was asking about this Akan guy early on. Exactly this is what happened. He saw the silver and the gold, right, and fine linen and all that. You shall not take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it, right? So if you ask me, what is the consequence? The consequence is this. You might take this and you might think, hey, look. Now, let's imagine this, right? Imagine you had taken... Now, by the way, they did dig up some of this gold and silver artwork. You can actually find in museums. They are actually very fine artwork. Now, imagine you start going through this land, conquering the land, and you found a little gold idol, beautifully made, right? And fine artwork, beautiful gold. And you thought, okay, maybe I can melt it down one day and do something. Okay, you keep it aside, right? And then let's say, you know, maybe somewhere along the line and, you know, maybe the weather is not too good, your harvest is not doing well and you are praying to God and things are not going well. You think to yourself, well, maybe I'll just try this, you know, harm is there, right? One God is good, two God better, right? So that's the sort of thing that happens, right? And God says, no, this will ensnare you. You pull your heart away. You have only one God. The Lord your God is one. So you should destroy them. Beautiful gold, destroy them, right? So sometimes we struggle with this. You know, what happens if someone becomes a Christian and he has idols that are very precious? Destroy them. That's not me saying it. I'm just saying it in the voice of Moses. Okay, so destroy them. Nor shall you bring an abomination into your house. Don't even bring it into your house. Okay, don't bring it in your house. But this word to'eva is a very interesting word. We shall do a study in a future chapter. But you shall not bring it into your house lest you be doomed to destruction just like it. You will utterly detest, utterly abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. This is your attitude, right? Don't even mention the name of any of this. Now, this is especially relevant to us because we are Chinese, right? Some of us are Chinese, but we are living in a kind of pagan culture, multi-religious background. There are lots of stuff, you know, feng shui lah, all these things. And sometimes we think, this is harmless lah, you know. Well, look, it might be harmless, but for a couple of reasons. First, don't underestimate how we might be ensnared by it, right? Secondly, don't underestimate how much God hates these things. And then sometimes we forget that altogether. But that brings us to the end of chapter 7 and the end of this episode. I hope this has been helpful to you. Once again, if you have questions that you might have as a result of listening, just put it down below in the comments. It could be Facebook, could be YouTube. Just put it down there. We'll try to look at that. And as we go along, we'll try to answer some of these. But God bless you as you keep His commandments.
We hope you enjoyed studying the Word of God. Join us again as we continue through the book of Devarim.